Okay, everybody hear me? All right, so I titled the talk The UGC Bucket List. I've been in it about a year. I've had a number of experiences where I kind of feel like I got a direction now, so this is kind of cover most of that. I'll give you a brief update about what the board has been up to for the last 12 months, which is significant. We've made a number of changes. And then I'll talk to you about some of the hard questions that we like to ask here. I'll dig in pretty deep to some carcass data records and just some things that I found out doing a little research. So a little few of the highlights. Probably the big one that the board took some considerable time on is we drafted and edited and approved some bylaws. U.S. Beef Breeds Council approved those this morning, actually. We performed 6 lab certifications. There's about 30 people nationwide certified that actually interpret the images that technicians send in. We went back to collecting carcass data at field certifications. We did 69 heads so far in 2018 and 19. We'll do 40 more at Kansas State University here in September. We discontinued in absentia field certification, and part of the reason is listed here. We are requiring field certification again for all 125 technicians. There's about 3, I believe, new machines that hit the marketplace within the last couple of years. Some technicians hadn't had any carcass data behind the equipment they were using for 15 years. Many had purchased a new machine and weren't actually using the same technology they certified on initially. And the big reason was we didn't have any images in our bank with carcass data behind them to actually assess whether those technicians were doing a good job. And we had no images to draw from to actually test the lab technicians to see if they could trace those new images. So it's a little bit of a turn back, but we're going to collect carcass data for the foreseeable future to make sure all those machines are operating within the standard. And then we changed scanning 20 head to scanning 40. We had used repeatability as a tool to try to assess whether a technician was doing a good job or they were consistent in the way they collected images. No one had ever failed a certification on repeatability alone, so we decided it was more advantageous to get 40 head collected with carcass records behind them than 20. So we expanded. The amount of time it takes to do the certification is the same. It's just twice as many animals. So the bylaws that just got approved made some significant changes as to how the board works in a rolling system. So we get one new breed rep every year. There's 4 total. Year 3, they're the vice chair. Year 4, they're the chair. There's three labs, up to 3 labs. There won't be any more than 3 lab representatives on the board. They have a continuous term. There's 1 certified field technician, 3 folks from academia, research, industry, and then the executive director. So your current board is as follows. We have a nomination on the floor for the 4th breed rep, but I don't think anybody's contacted him yet, so that person won't be listed until they actually say they're willing to serve. But that's your current board. I won't go through them one by one, but several of them are in this room. So the field technician certification process had a few changes, obviously, since in absentia went away. We still collect the same number of images, rump, ribeye, IMF. We scan 40 head of cattle. That's new. The animals are clipped and pre-scanned. We try to get as much variation as we can. It helps us with the stats and the ability to test the models to see if they're doing a good job. This is also new. At least 75% of the cattle will be harvested. In the recent certification we did in Iowa, all 40 were the plan for what's going to happen in Kansas. So all 40 of those cattle will be harvested as well. 3 minutes per head, continuing education program. Those items have been in place for some time. So I believe last year I posted this slide and talked a little bit about how when we knife a carcass, it's essentially the same tool as what we use when we put an ultrasound probe on an animal's back. And there's some problems with that, and I've dug into maybe why ultrasound has some errors. I'll go through that. So item number 1 on my bucket list is to try to prove that ultrasound data for ribeye and fat are not indicator traits. They're used that way in the genetic evaluation. So very few folks would argue with this statement. Birth weight is an indicator trait for calving yeast direct because calving yeast direct is how we get paid. We get paid with live calves. Well, if we use the same logic for the trait like ribeye, ultrasound ribeye area is an indicator trait for ribeye area EPD because carcass ribeye area is how we get paid. What about discounts when they get too big? It's not exactly the same type of situation. And I'll go through a little more detail as to why there's some problems with the carcass record. So ultrasound and carcass REA are both indicator traits for ribeye area EPD because USDA yield grade is actually how producers are paid on the rail. So fat thickness and carcass fat thickness are both equal indicator traits for USDA yield grade. And I'll talk about kind of how I've arrived at that here in a minute. Both knife cut removal and hydraulic hide pullers cause error. We've known that for some time. We're actually working on a study at Iowa State where we're actually taking quality grade and stratifying it and then looking at implant strategy and diet to see how those cattle actually separate. Haven't got that data to completely done. So what about camera grading? So camera grading is fairly new to the industry. It's been around a while, but it wasn't part of the industry when ultrasound started. So where we're getting carcass data from largely is different than where we got it from 20 years ago. So I did some digging online, and there's actually a certification process for certifying online camera graders, and it is eerily similar to what we do for ultrasound. So all these websites are listed here. It's all USDA.gov sites. You can find them with a simple Google search like I did. So I'll go through the traits here. Ribeye area was certified in 2003, or the protocol was developed in 2003. They have three experienced people that measure the ribeye, and then they average it, much like we just did with the field certification data. Those three experienced people also trace, then measure the ribeye on 600 images from the camera system, so much larger data set. And then here's their requirement. The R-square has to be 0.85 or greater if that online camera gets certified. Well, if you do the math, that's a correlation of 0.92. Just last fall, in our UGC certification, our field technicians correlated to an online camera grader at 0.87. So we're pretty close. Breed associations have historically given more genetic merit to the carcass ribeye area trait than the ultrasound ribeye area trait. And every breed does it differently. There's obviously some commonality between some breeds. So this is just my opinion. But it doesn't make any statistical logic to take all the error from one trait, meaning carcass, and give it all to ultrasound. And that's when we put it into an analysis and we gauge how well ultrasound did. That's what we do. We don't assume there was any error in the carcass data collection, and there is. So the yield grade protocol for the online camera was developed. Location. The other two look like they were ribbed with a chainsaw, but you can see that there was significant hide pull. So on a carcass data record, what fat thickness measurement do you get from those two on the right? Now, the one on the far right's not bad. You just move over. So what I'm trying to get at here is there's some observations that carcass data collects that aren't accurate. If we're being compared to ultrasound, we have to maybe acknowledge that there's some error on carcass data. So ribbing mistakes occur probably more often than we think. I was in the tainment plant waiting on our certification cattle just a few weeks ago, and I just watched carcasses go by for about an hour. I would say, in my opinion, 5 to 10% of those carcasses were ribbed either too far forward or too far back. So this image here on, image here on the right, you can see there's no spinalis muscle right there. That's an indicator we use in ultrasound to tell us where we're at. The acorn is also really small, and the medial end is really shallow. If we're training folks to take ultrasound images, we tell them that this image was collected behind the 13th rib, between that and the first lumbar. So to me, this carcass was ribbed, one rib too far back. Do I know that? No. But we use the secondary muscles in ultrasound to tell us where we were. This image here, the spinalis muscle is really pronounced. It goes clear over the acorn. That image is that ribeye carcass is ribbed too far forward. That causes error in both fat thickness and ribeye area. So what's the answer key? In reality, there really isn't one because there's error on both sides of the equation. Have we been doing it to the best of our ability so far? Probably. But for anybody that's been in a kill plant and counted dots on a moving carcass, if you're going to argue with me that that's more accurate than this, it's going to be a while. Because this uses the same type of outside information to establish a number as they do here. And, you know, the cameras are better, I would say, than the old way we used to do it. But there's obviously some perceived error there as well. So what about marbling score? They actually developed this just a year later in 2006 and then altered it in 2012. They used 5 people to determine marbling score within 30 minutes of when the carcass is ribbed. They then averaged that. So according to the carcass employees that I talked to, it's at 2 different plants. I could never find this information online. But according to them, USDA says it has to be 10 minutes between when they rib the carcass and when they grade it. The tainment plant runs about 11. Greater Omaha is closer to 12, 13. But it varies based on when they stop the chain, things like that. Carcasses were eliminated from the certification process if the panel didn't agree. That would be really nice if we did that with an ultrasound record that we couldn't agree on. They certified 4,000 head, 4 different trials. 3 images per carcass. That sound familiar to anybody that collects images on an ultrasound machine? We take 3 to 5 to determine IMF. And there's their stats, and I'm not going to bore you with all of the accuracy, but those are pretty stringent. Okay, they're pretty confident that their marbling score assessment is good. The one thing I found cool was the USDA graders, when they put those camera systems in their plant, they told them to poke holes in it. What's wrong with it? They complained that their override tolerance was too narrow on marbling. They could not assess coarse marbling cattle. It was inaccurate on really small or really large ribeyes. Guess what? Ultrasound struggles on really small and really large ribeyes as well. So their marbling tolerance was widened from 10 marbling score units out to 100, which 100 is essentially a full grade. Okay, from average choice to low, that's 100. And then relaxed it back to 40 in 2015. So it's still fairly accurate. So they tested 4 plants. 5.3% of the carcasses graded with the camera, the USDA graders stepped in and overrode the system. Of those 5.3%, almost 90% of them, it was a legitimate override. They needed to step in because the camera got it wrong. The camera had a positive bias to quality grade. And then once they altered the protocol, they blindly tested the same plants and didn't tell the USDA graders that they were being tested. And instead of overriding it 5% of the time, it fell to less than 1%. So when they didn't know they were being tested, it's kind of like they maybe didn't care as much. So plant-to-plant variation is one of the main reasons why we have to use IMF to assess ultrasound, because we can't use a carcass numeric marbling score consistently from plant to plant. So item number two, rump fat. When I was doing my thesis work, I always remember it was referred to in the really old texts as the breeding pad. It's fat that lays down early. Heifers usually lay it down a little quicker than bull calves do, but J.R. Tate, who's in here, piloted a lot of the research on rump fat. As I recall, he attempted to increase percent retail product, EPD. To my knowledge, it was done on all Boss Taurus cattle. So can we use rump fat to better assess some eared breeds, heifers only? Can we use a percentage of it in the fat thickness EPD? Graders use it, but it's visual. If you ever go down the line and watch a grader stamp carcasses, if there's a hide pull issue, the first thing they do is look up at the rump and say, how fat is he up there? And they adjust yield grades accordingly based on how fat they are everywhere else. So should we relook at it? Should some breed associations decide whether they want the trait or not? If they're not going to look at using it, then maybe we need to discontinue collecting it. I don't want that to happen. I think it's a good trait to collect. I just put this slide in here because I found online USDA protocol now includes dentition as an approved form of aging. I don't know how that applies to what we do because the teeth are in a really different part of the plant by the time we assess the carcass, but it is a part of the protocol. And the reason I put this in here is I did some carcass data a couple summers ago for some purebred, registered, papered steers in a carcass contest. And the grader called two of them Maturity B. And those steers were 14 months old. I had a birthday on them. And unfortunately, for one of the kids, he was right here. And the missed maturity call cost that kid $220. So we don't make that mistake with ultrasound, especially when we do it on seed stock. Obviously, we got the birth date to help us. But one of our advantages as well. So I don't have the answer key, but when I'm in kill plants, I talk to the carcass sales guys a lot and the USDA graders. I just kind of feel out what they do, what they how they operate. And there's been some pretty funny quotes that have stuck with me for a long time, because there's actually two people in a commercial packing plant that determine the value of a carcass. There's the USDA grader, but there's also the sales guy. And he can reclassify a carcass, he can send him down the regrade rail. He has a lot of influence on what actually gets stamped on that carcass, which pays the owner. This one just happened a few weeks ago. If we're short on premium choice, I usually just rail off about 5 head in the first hour. He gets mad, which that's the USDA grader, but he stamps them all after that. So he has influence on quality grade just by railing off cattle early on in the shift. We do rock, paper, scissors when the Louisiana guy hits the line. We continually stuff the regrade rails, but he doesn't seem to know why. There was one USDA grader in a plant I worked in years ago, and he wasn't very good. And the carcass sales folks would just absolutely load the regrade rail and have them gone through all again because they didn't agree with how they stamped them. This one was a few years ago as well. I was watching big carcasses load on an out truck, and they all weighed north of 1,000 or north of 1,050, but the grid price was always 950 and higher. You got the heavy discount. Well, he told me that we start discounting on the grid at 950, but they're not actually considered out cattle until 1,050. So they were making money on anything that weighed 950 to 1,050. And one of them just said, I don't carry a knife because he's always right. I mean, they'll peel off a grade and not even stop the line, but just look at the USDA grader and say, come on, is he really select? And they'll change grades at line speed pretty often. So bucket list item number three is to kind of address the marbling bell curve. And this is just a picture of a bell curve, but if you can imagine that this end is practically devoid. And this end is maybe like the most prime Wagyu animal on the planet. We are asking an ultrasound machine to assess marbling on that whole bell curve. Well, when I was in graduate school, from what I remember about the original data set that we certified IMF models on, the cattle that did that looked closer to that. A few selects, probably not very many standards, probably not very many primes. Well, should we look at something like this? If we're going to develop a really robust IMF model, we need a bunch of bad ones, a bunch of good ones, and the same number of everything in between. So what about if we developed a model for this group of cattle? Could we do better? What about if we developed a model for that group of cattle? Could we do better? Robert Williams just started with Wagyu. He has approached me already about doing something like this in the blue, because those are the cattle we want to identify. We want to get rid of those and propagate those. These cattle are really easy to find. Our models do a really good job there, I think, but we maybe could we make them better on the ends? I don't know the answer to that. Number four is the struggle with fat and prime. Once we get there, those cattle, unfortunately, are the hardest ones to scan. And if you guys are looking at that screen, you know why the technicians sit in a dark room when they look at ultrasound images, because you can't see a whole heck of a lot. Those two animals are over 10% IMF. And they're not too fat. 5/6 tenths, maybe 7 on the right. But we can't see a heck of a lot on the left side of this screen. So how do we address that, or can we? Number five is the struggle with technology. In humans, ultrasound images are impacted by skin tone, nationality, body condition. You talk to I have a friend who does pregnant women. They don't all scan the same, and they mess with their gain settings, all of the settings that we hold constant to try to get the best picture they can. We haven't touched an Alloca machine. Well, now that I heard Lee Leachman, we probably haven't touched an Alloca machine setting since 1988. Maybe that's the best we could ever get out of that system, and we did it right in the first place. All these new systems that we've got, I'm sure we played with gain settings to try to get a good image, but if we look at a practically devoid animal or maybe a full-blood Zebu breed, should we use different settings than on maybe a Wagyu? I don't know the answer to that, but we haven't really looked at it. So the other issue we're having, the machine size. So this machine here on the left is a brand new machine that you might see in a hospital for humans. Okay, they're not making them any smaller. They're about the same size, have been for some time. They range in price from $1,500 to $50,000 and north. So some of the really high-tech ultrasound machines in hospitals can detect oxygenated or deoxygenated blood flow. Blows my mind. We don't use that kind of machine for carcass ultrasound. This is the other aspect. They're going with really, really small, really compact, and cheaper so that folks can afford them. But the ability for them to do carcass ultrasound on most of those machines is pretty limited, if not impossible, because they won't make a carcass probe for us. There's very few. Right now there's, I think, essentially 4 or 5 that are willing to manufacture a carcass probe. So we were here on the right, these picture, these two machines. We were there for a long time, over 10 years, and it worked. So my summary, I guess, is UGC, and when I say UGC, I mean me, because I'm collecting all the carcass data. I'm going to try to mirror the USDA procedure and use multiple people to assess a ribeye, multiple people to measure a fat, multiple people to do marbling score, and see if we can improve the stats for ultrasound if we adopt their procedure. Or we use camera data, because we know that camera has been through a certification process and we have someone else behind the camera validating whether we think that's right or not. I think BIF should consider adopting the USDA certification protocol for carcass data selection. It's pretty good. I don't know, do we have one? For carcass data that goes into a genetic evaluation, is there a protocol that they must follow? Okay. Or maybe we alter the genetic value given to ultrasound versus carcass. Obviously, I work for all the ultrasound technicians, and they want as much value out of their work as we get out of carcass work. And there's some argument that says they should. When all 125 technicians have carcass data behind their machine, I'm going to send a summary of the data to the breed associations to just update them on how ultrasound works. It's been around for a while, but we've got a lot of new technologies that haven't been around for a while. They need to know how they work. I think at that point, we may be able to address item one. You know, are they really indicator traits, or can we look at them differently? Once we know all the machines work, then maybe we can look at that. Breed associations need to individually decide on item number two, which is rump fat. If you're going to use it, great. If you're never going to even look at it, we probably shouldn't slow down and shave the rump and take the image and do all the necessary things to collect it. I think it has value. We just need to make sure we use it. Should UGC work with Bos Indicus breeds to pursue IMF models? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm not sure we're doing a great job on the eared breeds. I don't know that. But most of the initial research in ultrasound was done on Bos Taurus. And number four and five, there's real no answer there. The battle's going to continue. I think we're in a good spot right now because we have three new systems that are supported. There's maintenance behind them. They're still selling them. So that I think we've won the battle for a while. And with that, I'm done. Questions?